Akatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. If you want to understand, you know, why Russia acts the way it does on the global stage, or maybe why its internal politics seem to cycle so dramatically, you really have to go back further than the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So today we are opening up Jeffrey Hosking's really quite seminal works on Russian history.
Yeah, this feels like a really critical deep dive for right now, doesn't it? I mean, you look at the headlines and you see this pattern autocratic control, there may be these brief, sometimes violent reforms, and then whoosh, it snaps right back to authoritarianism. It seems almost relentless.
It does. It feels like history just repeating itself, kind of on a loop sometimes.
Yeah.
So our mission today really is to try and cut through some of that complexity for you, the listener.
Right.
We want to give you that fundamental historical framework, maybe that aha moment that helps explain this repeating cycle. Why is Russia different in these ways?
And the answer, which is really Hosking's core idea, his central thesis, it hinges on this structural flaw, something built into the civilization almost from the very beginning.
Right.
It's this persistent, almost inescapable tension between Russia as an empire and Russia as a nation.
Mm.
That conflict, that specific dynamic, really dictates almost everything we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
But maybe before we unpack that that huge paradox, let's talk for a second about the man who framed it so clearly, Jeffrey Hosking.
Right.
He's one of Britain's most distinguished scholars of Russia, emeritus professor at University College London, and he's dedicated, gosh, over four decades to synthesizing this enormous subject.
And his credentials, I think, are really key to why his analysis hits so hard. It's not just the archival depth or the linguistic skills, though he has those,
mm-hmm.
but he was also a very active scholar during the late Soviet era. And crucially, he actually witnessed the Soviet collapse firsthand. He was there.
Yeah, that timing gave him this kind of remarkable vantage point, didn't it? He saw the fall of the Romanovs through the historical texts, sure, but he saw the Soviet structure crumble in real time.
Right.
And that allows him, I think, to offer a real analytical objectivity. He tends to avoid, you know, romanticizing the past or just demonizing the present state. His core focus is more sociological.
Okay.
It's about the interplay between this massive, incredibly powerful state structure and the, well, comparatively weak and underdeveloped society, or what he terms the nation.
So he's giving us a framework for analysis, not just a sort of march through dates and events. That's exactly what we need. He pulls from sociology, political science.
Yeah, he synthesizes these complex narratives in a way that's actually accessible, even if you're not a Russia specialist, but you're, you know, intellectually curious.
Okay, so let's unpack that core thesis then. Hosking argues, you said, that Russian civilization developed differently because it became an empire first and a nation second.
Exactly. And that's the reversal, the key reversal of the typical pattern you see in Western Europe. Think about England or France often.
Mm-hmm.
You get a cohesive national identity solidifying first,
mm-hmm.
and then that nation maybe starts to expand outwards. In Russia, the state had to grow powerful and expansionist almost immediately. It was driven by this just overwhelming need for security across those huge, open, vulnerable territories.
Right, the sheer geography. And what was the consequence then, the structural result of putting the imperial state first?
Well, the consequence was that this constantly expanding state project, it sort of necessarily suppressed the growth of the things that make up a strong nation. Things like local autonomy, individual rights, a robust civil society.
So the empire was built kind of on top of a fragile foundation, the nation itself, and it's been trying to hold that foundation down ever since.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. And the book covers this vast sweep over a millennium, from Kievan Rus's through the trauma of the Mongols, the Romanov Empire building, the whole Soviet experiment, and right up to the post-Soviet identity crisis.
And the goal isn't just recounting events.
No, not at all. It's showing how that fundamental imbalance state versus nation shaped Russia's political culture at every single major turning point. So if we start right back at the early foundations, Hosking points out how geography created these really profound ongoing constraints. You know, the sheer scale, the vulnerability of those vast open plains, plus the harsh climate.
Yeah.
It just demanded strong centralized authority. You needed it for defense. You needed it for basic resource extraction just to survive.
It created a unique kind of vulnerability from the start, but faith also played a big role in shaping the power structure, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The pivotal moment there was the adoption of Byzantine Orthodox Christianity around 988. That decision oriented Russia eastward, culturally and religiously, away from Rome and the West.
And crucially.
Crucially, Orthodoxy brought with it the concept of symphonia, this ideal of harmony or unity between the church and the state. And that, from the very beginning, tended to reinforce the ruler's autocratic power.
Unlike the Catholic Church in the West, which often clashed with kings and emperors.
Exactly. The Catholic Church was often a rival power center. The Orthodox Church, generally speaking, reinforced the Tsar's authority, gave it a kind of divine backing.
Okay, so geography and faith set the stage. But if we look at historical turning points, Hosking calls the Mongol period the Yoke, as it's known, the single most important formative event. That's a huge claim. Why does he put so much weight on the Mongol Yoke? More than Orthodoxy, even more than Peter the Great's reforms.
It's a big claim, yeah, but he argues it's because it fundamentally altered the DNA of Russian statecraft. The princes of Muscovy, the state centered around Moscow, they learned how to survive and eventually how to thrive by basically working within the Mongol system.
How so? What lessons did they learn?
They mastered lessons in absolute, completely unquestioned authority. They learned ruthless, efficient taxation methods from the Mongols, and they adopted obligatory military conscription. These became tools of the Muscovite state.
So Muscovy didn't just, you know, fight off the Mongols eventually. It sort of inherited and then perfected their system, a system of centralized, militaristic, extractive statecraft.
That's precisely his argument.
Mm-hmm.
The looser, perhaps more federal structure of Kievan Rus' was replaced over time by this rigid, autocratic, and you could even say paranoid state structure,
mm-hmm.
modeled partly on Mongol methods.
And that structure gets consolidated later on.
Yes, under rulers like Ivan the Terrible. He really formalized the paranoid, absolute nature of this autocracy. Think about his Oprichnina, that campaign of terror against the noble class, the boyars.
Right.
It was explicitly designed to show that the ruler's power was completely above society, above any law, securing his control through sheer brutality if necessary.
So if Ivan perfected the terror aspect, then Peter the Great perfected the state machine itself. It's always fascinated me how Peter imported all this Western technology, modern ships, new bureaucracy, administrative techniques.
Yeah.
Yet Hosking says this only ended up reinforcing the autocracy. Why didn't that Western modernization lead towards, you know, Western-style liberty or political structures?
And that's maybe the core contradiction that Hosking keeps coming back to. Peter the Great was this ultimate modernizing autocrat.
Yeah.
He borrowed Western methods, absolutely, but he combined them with, let's say, Asian authority structures.
Right.
He grew the state's power exponentially. New army, new navy, new administration. But it came at this immense cost of further subjugating society. He formalized serfdom, made it even harsher in some ways. He forced the nobility into compulsory state service. Modernization was purely instrumental.
For strengthening the imperial state.
Exactly. Not for liberating the people or developing the nation in that sense.
And that deep contradiction, it just gets deeper in the 19th century, doesn't it? You have Catherine the Great expanding the empire further, but also deepening serfdom.
Hmm.
But then, almost accidentally, she creates the first truly independent cultural sphere, the intelligentsia, by freeing the nobility from that compulsory state service later in her reign.
It's a fantastic historical irony, isn't it? The state, in a way, created the very educated class that would eventually dedicate itself to challenging the state.
And then you get Alexander II's great reforms, the emancipation of the serfs in 1861 is the big one.
Huge moment. A massive top-down attempt to modernize Russia after the Crimean War defeat.
Right.
But Hosking argues it was fatally incomplete.
Why incomplete?
Because the state remained terrorized by its fundamental fear of losing autocratic control. The reforms didn't go far enough, especially in solving the deep agrarian crisis, the land question for the peasants. And ultimately, these half-measures just ended up fueling more revolutionary discontent.
Which eventually explodes in 1917.
Right.
And that brings us to the Soviet experiment. Now, Hosking views the 1917 revolution as, well, both a rejection of the old Romanov dynasty, clearly, but also, paradoxically, a kind of radical continuation of Russian history. How does that work?
Well, the Soviet state, especially once Stalin consolidated power, became what Hosking kind of describes as a metastatic version of that traditional Russian imperial state.
Metastatic, meaning?
Meaning it spread everywhere. It took over everything. It was hyper-centralized, absolutely obsessed with state security, expansionist. But now it was armed with this totalizing ideology, Marxism-Leninism, which allowed for really unprecedented levels of control over the entire population.
So things like Stalin's collectivization of agriculture or the forced industrialization drives, they weren't just communist policies in isolation.
Hosking would argue, no, not entirely. They were essentially supercharged, incredibly brutal versions of Peter the Great's state-driven resource extraction. just using new ideological justifications and, frankly, more advanced technology for control and repression. The underlying pattern of the state dominating society for its own ends repeats.
Wow. Okay, so the pattern holds right up until the collapse.
Pretty much. Which brings us to Gorbachev. His reforms glasnost, meaning openness, and perestroika, restructuring, were, by most accounts, genuine attempts to revitalize, maybe even save, the Soviet system.
But they failed.
They failed, Hosking argues, precisely because they unintentionally released all those national forces, the aspirations of the different ethnic groups within the USSR, that the empire had been specifically designed to suppress for centuries.
So the moment that central autocratic grip loosened just a little bit,
the whole multi-ethnic imperial structure fractured along its national fault lines. And that leads directly to the profound identity crisis of post-Soviet Russia, the struggle we still see today.
Which is what exactly?
It's the struggle of trying to exist, perhaps for the first time, as a stable nation state without that defining central historical role of being an empire. That's the core problem. So looking back across this whole vast sweep of history through Hosking's lens, there may be three key themes that really jump out. And they feel incredibly relevant right now.
Okay.
The first, and obviously the most central, is the empire-nation paradox itself.
Right, that core conflict we started with, this constant grinding tension between Russia's vast territorial ambitions, its imperial nature, and the challenge of actually building a cohesive, functional national identity underneath it all.
Exactly. And Hosking shows how this imbalance, this structural weakness, helps explain why so often in Russian political calculation, state security and state control seem to just automatically override concerns about individual liberty or the development of civil society.
This is like the default setting baked in by history.
Pretty much. Yep. And then the second theme is what you might call adaptive autocracy and control.
Adaptive? How so?
Well, autocracy is the deep continuity, isn't it? It runs right from the medieval princes through the czars, the Soviet general secretaries, and arguably into the post-Soviet era. It's adaptive. It takes new forms.
Okay.
It uses new ideologies, orthodoxy, Marxism, Leninism, maybe nationalism today. It uses new technology. It uses new rhetoric. But the core characteristics remain remarkably consistent. The concentration of power at the very top, and the subordination of society to the goals set by the state.
It changes its clothes, but not its fundamental nature. And the third theme.
The third one, which is just crucial for understanding the 21st century, is modernization without liberalization.
Okay, explain that.
Russia has this long, long history of borrowing specific things from the West, usually technology, military organization, administrative methods, things could be used to strengthen the state itself. Peter the Great is the classic example, but it continues through Soviet industrialization and even today.
Right. Importing the tools.
Importing the tools, exactly. But while importing Western methods, there's been this consistent rejection of Western political values. Things like the rule of law, genuinely independent courts, checks and balances on power, democratic accountability.
So it's a hybrid approach.
It's this hybrid approach.
Sure.
Seeking the power that comes with modernity, but without accepting the limitations on state power that usually accompany it in the West. Understanding that pattern is absolutely vital for analyzing contemporary Russian economic strategy, military buildup, everything.
It's clear Hosking offers these really potent, concise ideas. They almost act like analytical shortcuts, helping you make sense of centuries of pretty complex history.
Yeah, they're like frameworks for thinking, aren't they? The first one is just so simple, but so devastatingly insightful. Russia became an empire before it became a nation, and this sequence has affected all subsequent Russian history.
Boom. That just lays out the structural weakness of civil society right there.
It really does. Yeah. Then there's that persistent observation about the power imbalance. The Russian state has always been stronger than Russian society, and this imbalance has shaped the character of both. That relationship, where the state essentially dictates terms to society, is just constant throughout the history he presents.
And tying the methods together is that phrase you mentioned earlier. Russian rulers have consistently sought to combine European methods with Asian authority structures.
Yeah, that captures that hybrid nature perfectly, doesn't it? Borrowing the technology, but keeping the, well, the despotism, you might say.
And finally, his take on the 20th century, which is quite nuanced. The Soviet Union was both the culmination of Russian history and a radical break with it.
Right. It was a break in terms of its official ideology, Marxism, Leninism replacing czarism and orthodoxy. But it was also a radical continuation, maybe even an intensification, of the traditional state structure, its centralization, its expansionist drive, and its ambition for total control.
So, okay, this is fascinating historical analysis, but how does it actually apply? How does understanding this deep history help us make sense of the world we live in right now?
Well, first off, it provides absolutely essential context for understanding modern geopolitics and Russian foreign policy. Hosking's analysis strongly suggests that a lot of modern Russian foreign policy, particularly toward its neighbors,
like Ukraine or reactions to NATO expansion.
Exactly. It isn't just driven by contemporary grievances, though those exist. It's also driven by this deep-seated historical sense of paranoia.
Paranoia rooted in?
Rooted in that vulnerable geography we talked about, the vast open plains. And this creates a persistent perceived need for buffer zones. So expansion isn't always seen purely as aggression. Historically, it's often been framed internally as a necessary defensive act.
To secure that vulnerable core by pushing potential threats as far away as possible.
Precisely. Understanding that historical pattern of defensive aggression is critical. It doesn't excuse actions, but it helps explain the underlying strategic thinking. It's a deep historical impulse, not just a decision made yesterday.
That makes sense. And what about looking inside Russia, internal governance?
Well, analyzing internal governance becomes much clearer, too, I think. When you see the struggles that pluralistic democracy has faced in post-Soviet Russia, it's maybe less surprising when viewed through this historical lens.
Because the foundations weren't there?
The historical weakness of civil society, of independent institutions like the judiciary or a free press, they simply weren't strong enough, historically speaking, to really bear the weight of a rapid democratic transition when that top-down autocratic control was suddenly lifted.
Mm-hmm.
The historical patterns just naturally favored a return to centralized power. So that's where the system tended to default back to.
So for you, the listener, the really broad insight here is just the immense value of historical perspective, isn't it?
Absolutely.
This kind of analysis teaches you to look beyond the immediate headlines, beyond the personalities of current leaders, and to understand the deep structural continuities, the geographic factors, the cultural patterns that shape behavior over the long term, not just in Russia, but arguably in any complex multi-ethnic state with a long history.
Yeah, it helps you see the sort of historical software that's still running underneath the modern interface, if you like. You know, if I had to pick one final thought or takeaway that really struck me from revisiting Hosking, it's how much emphasis he places on that Mongol period.
Right, you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah. The idea that it provided the actual blueprint for the autocratic state that followed, it just shows how these seemingly external shocks, these invasions or occupations, can fundamentally reshape a civilization's internal identity, its political DNA.
Yes.
Really long, long after the invaders themselves are gone, the legacy endures.
That's a powerful point. And maybe that leads to the final sort of provocative thought for the listener to consider. Hosking's work really demonstrates that Russia's toughest challenge today, perhaps the defining challenge, is one it has arguably never successfully faced before in its entire history.
Which is
learning how to define itself, how to exist simply as a nation among other nations rather than its historical default mode. Being an empire surrounded by perceived vassals or enemies, that deep unresolved conflict between the imperial past and the possibility of a normal national future, well, it remains entirely unresolved. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.